Good morning. We are going to finish the Ten Commandments this year, like I promised. And I know it's not the last Sunday of the month. It's the first Sunday of the month, so I'm pretty close if you think about it. Not too far off. We got a little off at one point, but we're going to be back on track as we cover this one today. And then at the end of August, because it's now August somehow, we will pick up with the next one in our order. Today we're covering the number six out of our Ten Commandments. Remember, we started our series this summer or this year with an introductory lesson about what are the Ten Commandments, and we discussed how they're really a summation, a boiled down version of the entirety of the Law of Moses. And we're learning a lot through these studies that teach us that the Ten Commandments, while not explicitly written as Ten Commandments in the New Testament under the Law of Christ, we're learning that these are valuable principles that God expects from His people of all times. And I think that that's not on accident. As we said, it's a summation of what God expects from His people. And the rest of the commands of the law, the several hundreds of commandments that are specific to the Jewish nation, we're not covering those. Those don't apply to us as such, but certainly, if nothing else, we can learn a lot about the character of God. And as we talked about in our study, the three basic points that we want to get across and we want to try to wrestle with as we learn from these Ten Commandments are these three things. Number one, we're seeing a revelation of God's holy character. When God tells us, as we're going to look at, "Thou shalt not kill," then we're learning about God's goodness and the value that He places on the life of man. And we're learning about God's holiness. And then when we see that God has to tell people something which seems so obvious, like, you know, don't have other gods before me, and don't lie, and don't kill, and respect your parents, and honor them, it tells us a little bit about ourselves, that we are at times tempted to act in such ways, to fall into sins like this. The people of all times, we've seen that the Israelites, they broke every one of the Ten Commandments along the way, and ultimately it led to their captivity. But we're confronted by our character. You know, we at times, as Paul said in Romans, we fall short of the holy character of God. And thirdly, to learn how we can bridge the gap, how we can grow closer to God and to grow closer to His perfect character of holiness, developing our own character along the way and learning from Him. So we get to Exodus chapter 20 and verse 13. It's very simple, very short, and you guys are going to like this one today. You shall not murder. And the reason I say you're going to like it today is because if there was any Bible commandment that we could probably say, I've never been close to being guilty of that, it's this one, right? I don't think we've got any convicted murderers in our midst today. And if so, welcome. We're glad you're here. You're in the right place. But, you know, we think about a topic like this, and I know we've sort of been looking forward and maybe thinking through the Ten Commandments and what's going to be coming up. And we've probably seen in ourselves, well, you know, I've never killed anybody, so that's going to be a freebie. That's going to be just a lesson where, you know, we'll show up, and maybe that's why I sprung it on you on the first instead of the last Sunday of the month. But this is something that we feel sort of smug about at times. You know, I've never killed anybody. This is one that I get a break on this one, right? Well, I want to challenge that mode of thought today. I want to challenge that and suggest that we shouldn't get too comfortable, because application of this command, while it is a command of something we should not do, as we've discussed, God is teaching a principle to live by. And there is a principle that supports this specific command, don't murder. And it's that principle that I want us to really dig out today, and I want us to get into. And I want us to think about the fact that even though hopefully no one here would ever go so far as to take the life of another person, that we need to consider what is really being taught in a command like this. Remember, God's holiness, our separation from that, and how we can learn from that. So I want to ask some questions here right off the bat that we're hopefully going to answer adequately as we go through our lesson. Simple questions, ones that we think, okay, these are pretty obvious answers, but again, when we start to think about that, why we answer the questions the way we do, it's going to help us to understand why murder and things that lead to murder are things we need to guard against. So number one, why is murder such a grievous sin? Why is it so terrible? Why ultimately is it wrong to take the life of another human being? Certainly people have wrestled with that through the ages. particularly people that have convinced themselves that murder is a viable option in their life. So before we discount this and say that's not even a question, that's a silly thing to ever ask. Well, you know, it is something that we need to understand. What makes it so wrong? Important for us, what did Jesus have to say about murder? Riley read some stuff that Jesus said about love and hate and our relationship with other people. And ultimately, we're reading through the Ten Commandments. What does any of it have to do with us today? So let's dig in. Number one, I want us to talk about the Old Testament on murder. And we're not going to exhaust the subject here. Because there's a ton that the Old Testament says about murder. There's a lot, if we start getting into the laws that Moses brought down off Sinai, the laws that were given to the people, there were lots of clauses about, you know, the different degrees of murder, first degree murder, second degree murder, accidental murder, negligent homicide. You know, if your ox kills a guy and you don't kill the ox, then it kills someone else, you're guilty of murder in that case. And we're not going to go through all those different examples because our purpose isn't to examine the law of Moses. But I want us to get some concepts from the Old Testament that lead us up to a command like this in Exodus 20. Why is this in the Ten Commandments? Shouldn't it be an obvious thing? And then ultimately we're going to keep going through and see what Jesus had to say. This is all founded on one principle that we have to understand. The reason why murder is so wrong, taking the life of another individual is ultimately wrong, is because of the sanctity of life. Follow me in Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the water. And we understand that he goes through and he, in 6 days, created everything there was to create. And on the seventh day, he rested. Before he rested, on the sixth day, his last day of creation, we see a conversation that takes place among the Godhead in verses 26 through 30 of Genesis chapter 1. And in this passage, the writer says, "Then God says, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, over the livestock, over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." Verse 27, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heavens, over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth. Every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for food. And to every beast on the earth, and to every kind of bird in the heavens, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so." So God, in the finality of his creation, says, "I make man in my own image." That right off the bat tells us that we are unique. We're special. Mankind, humanity, is the crown jewel of God's creation. Certainly, as humans, we look and we think, maybe the universe is the crown jewel. The beauty of the heavens, that's impressive to me. But that's not the crowning achievement of God's creation. He didn't save the best for last in that case. He did that pretty early on. The last thing he does is he creates man and female in his own image. And he talks about how man has dominion. Man is above the animals and the plants and all the other things that he's created. But we go to Genesis chapter 9. And God tells a little bit more about this to Noah after the flood. And I understand that this is not quite up to the point of the Ten Commandments yet. In fact, it's quite a bit earlier. A lot happens between these two positions in time. But I want us to read the first 7 verses of Genesis 9. Notice what God is teaching Noah about the sanctity, the value of human life. He says, "And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." Now, we're going to hear some similarities between what we just read in Genesis chapter 1, but with some important differences. Starting with verse 2, "The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon the birds of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the flesh of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered." Now, in Genesis chapter 1, we get the picture of the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve live amongst the animals and there's no fear. In Genesis chapter 9, God says, now that they're off the ark, they're going to fear mankind. And if you want to eat them, you're going to have to hunt them and catch them. And he goes on to say there in verse 3, "Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. As I gave you the plants, I give you everything, but you shall eat flesh with its life, that is its blood." Now he's placing an importance on living things. There is value. There is, as we've talked about so often, when we talk about the scheme, the plan of God's redemption, there's life in the blood. And he says in verse 5, "For your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it from man and from man. From his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man." Verse 6, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. And you be fruitful and multiply. Team on the earth and multiply in it." Verse 6 is of utmost importance for our study. He says, in addition to what was all given in chapter 1 of Genesis, that I'm making man in my image and that he has dominion over everything, he then adds in this important part, after saying life is in the blood of an individual, life has value. He says, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. And why is that the case? Why does life demand life? Why does murder demand a consequence? He tells us, verse 6, "For God made man in his own image." Life is valuable. Human life is valuable. He doesn't say that if you go and you shoot a deer and you eat that deer, or if you have your cow processed and you eat that beef, that you better watch out because some animal is going to come and try to repay you for that. Sometimes we may argue that deer run out in front of our cars to try to get us back. But the point is, there is a value on life as a whole, but specifically on the value of human life to human life. And there's an importance in that. There's a special sanctity to that. So what is it built on here? It's built on the fact that we're made in God's image. We're different from animals. Human life is precious. And as it said in Job chapter 1, verse 21, Job says, "The Lord gives and the Lord takes away." Now here Job is just saying, in a matter of justifying what's happening around me, God gave it to me, God can take it away. But when it comes to life itself, it's the Lord who gives, the Lord who breathed the breath of life into the nostrils of man so that he lived. And it's God alone who has the right and the responsibility to take that life away or determine who is able to take that life away. Life is valuable, it is sacred, and it belongs to God. That ultimately is the root of all of this. That's why murder is such a grievous thing. And we know that shortly after the sin, the first sin in the garden, that murder is the next thing on the menu with Cain and Abel. And there are reasons why. There are attitudes behind that murder that are really important for us to understand. And we won't get into all of that today. Another major point that we see throughout the Old Testament in regards to murder and the shedding of blood is the fact that the shedding of innocent blood pollutes the land. It pollutes the land. We see a little bit of that, a taste of that with Cain. Remember, he killed his innocent brother. He shed innocent blood, and because of that, it was nearly impossible for him to work the land. You know, it doesn't mean that if we murder someone, we will be terrible gardeners. But we see the image played out more. So we look at a passage like Isaiah chapter 1, verse 21. A very pointed condemnation against Jerusalem. It says, "How the faithful city has become a whore, she who is full of justice, righteousness lodged in her, but now murderers." That reminds us of some of the stipulations that were made under the old law regarding cities of refuge, right? And with cities of refuge, how if there was a murder, that you were able to flee to one of those cities to wait for justice to take place, so that it wasn't just the wild, wild west in ancient Israel. And so it was to be that there were places of justice where justice occurred and righteousness dwelt, even God's special city in Jerusalem. But it was no longer faithful, it was an adulteress, it was not just or right anymore, it was full of murderers. And we certainly see that as they went through and broke the commandments of God, the Ten Commandments, the individual laws, murder was something that was brought up time and time and time again. Oftentimes we say the reason they went into captivity is because of their idolatry. It's a big part of it. That's not the only reason, though. It's because of every single one of the commandments. We can make a case. And they were murderers. They were people who shed innocent blood, and God judged them for that. You probably have the wheels turning in your head. You could probably think of innocent blood that is shed on a regular basis and how God obviously disdains that. And we'll get into that a little bit in a minute. And we're not going to get, as I said, we're not going to exhaust the subject in the Old Testament. We're going to move on. And I want us to think about it, the fact that it's more than murder. Jesus teaches us that it's more than just the act of physically taking someone else's life. There's a lot more behind it. And I believe that's the case even in Exodus 20 when God said, "You shall not murder." That he obviously wanted to get rid of and prevent anything that would even lead to murder. We know that because of a commandment like, "You shall love the Lord your God, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." If you love your neighbor as yourself, you're not going to have attitudes towards other people that are going to lead you to want to do something so heinous. What does Jesus say about it? Well, he challenges us. We go to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, and I want us to read a few verses there, the verses that we see on the screen here, 21 through 26. Matthew 5, beginning of verse 21. On the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus here says, "You have heard it said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment.'" Key thing to focus in on here. When Jesus says, "You have heard it said," what he's referring to is, you know, the tradition that has been passed down by your leaders. They say this. And oftentimes when Jesus talks, he says, "You've heard it said." In other words, your people think this is how it is, but I'm going to teach you the way that God really intended it for it to be. We see a good example of that in Matthew 19 when he teaches on divorce. And he said, "Well, Moses, you know, Moses allowed him to give a certificate of divorce." And he says, "Well, you know, that's a stipulation that took place, but that's not the way God intended for it to be." We understand the concept here. So back to verse 21. "You've heard it said, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment.'" That's really like a local court judgment. That's not eternal hellfire judgment that they're talking about. But in verse 22, Jesus says, "But I say to you," that is the teaching of God, "is that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. And whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council," which is a stronger form of judgment. That'd be for special criminal cases. "And whoever says, 'You fool,' will be liable to the hell of fire." That's eternal punishment. And so what we've got here is Jesus says, "You guys think that murder is just a trivial case, but I'm going to put it in perspective here." And he says there, being angry, that's the trivial case, so to speak. But he says, if you go on and you insult your brother, then that's a stronger case against you. And he says that if you want the worst kind of condemnation, get to the point where you are insulting your brother by saying, "You fool." And I want us to talk about what that really means. Number one is we have to keep the broad context in mind. That it's not just the action, but it's the attitude behind it. That's what Jesus is teaching here. He's teaching that it's not just what you do, but it's everything that goes behind it. Let's pick up reading in verse 23. He says, "So if you're at the offering, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny." So he talks about the attitude here and the importance of reconciling these relationships. So that's the broader context here. The first thing he says is that if you are angry with your brother, you're liable for judgment. What he's teaching us is about murder. They say murder. And he says, actually, if you're angry and you harbor anger against your brother, if you keep in your mind an anger towards an individual, he says, use your common sense and think it through. That's how murder starts. It starts in the mind. It starts in the heart. That's when we need to take care that we're not guilty of that. But he says, continuing on, when we insult other people, don't you think what we're really doing is seeing them as inferior to us? If I walk around and I insult people, that means I think I'm better than they are. If I say someone else is a fool, that means I think that I'm pretty smart. And when we start to devalue other people, when we start to see other human beings as less valuable to society or to God than myself, we start to see why Jesus took it so seriously. He said that insults like that, demeaning other people, is a very serious crime. It can lead to that. He goes on, as we just read in verses 23 and following, unresolved conflicts these things can fester. He says, in a manner of speaking, just like in the Old Testament, they had to be cleansed of their impurities before they were allowed to worship God. In this case, if you want to bring a gift to the altar, he says, it's worthless if you've got something going on, an unresolved conflict. The call for us today is resolve your conflicts. Seek out those that you have issues with and make those amends. Do you see how Jesus is placing a large importance on that event? Your worship's meaningless if you're not loving your neighbor, if you're not loving others the way that God loves them. Unresolved conflicts. James actually adds to this if we flip over to James chapter 4. James chapter 4, verses 1 and 2 there. And James gives us an additional reason why murders occur. And he says there in chapter 4, verse 1, what causes quarrels? What causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? Verse 2, he says, you desire and you do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. What he's saying here is he's lumping in some of the other of the commandments that we'll read later, about covetousness particularly, and greed and envy, these things. Greed for what other people have, thinking that I would be happier if I had what they have, and thinking that I wish I was that person, I wish that I could, and we frustrate ourselves with those things. He says that's why we quarrel, that's why we fight, that's why we're angry. It's because we don't control our desires, because we don't focus on the things that are best. Ultimately, what Jesus teaches is that the source of murder and the promoter of murder, its biggest advocate is, of course, Satan. In John chapter 8, verse 44, Jesus makes no buts about it here. And he says, you are of your father, the devil. Remember, they're saying we're Abraham's children. We're children of Abraham. We're children of the promise. He says, well, actually, no. You're of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. That is, the things you're doing is, that's the desires of Satan. That's not the desires of God. What about Satan here? He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there's no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies. Really interesting thing about Satan there that I think helps us understand God a little bit, because he's the opposite. God is saying here, Jesus is saying here, that whenever he speaks, it is a lie because that's just who he is. Now, on the other hand, whenever God speaks, it's the truth, because God can't lie. Just like Satan can't tell the truth, God can't lie. And we see the polar opposites there, and hopefully that impresses upon us the goodness of God. But what he's saying here is that they're of their father. And he's saying that their father is Satan. And that's why Peter and John can say later in Acts chapter 3, you denied the holy and righteous one and asked for a murderer to be granted to you, and you killed the author of life whom God raised from the dead. To this we are witnesses. It says, you're murderers, like your father was a murderer. Of course, this is the prime example of murder in the Bible, you would think. But these people were told that they were of their father, and it wasn't Abraham, and it wasn't God. And that helps us to understand the source of murder, the source of the attitudes behind murder. It's not a godly attitude. It's these demonic thoughts, these things that Satan tempts us with. But we also need to understand that even though Jesus was teaching about something deeper than that, he was telling them, ultimately, that the gospel is still for murderers. That the gospel is still for people that are, as we might think, the worst of the worst. And so we see, as we go to like Acts chapter 2. In chapter 3, he says, you denied the Holy One. You asked for a murderer. You had him killed. Acts chapter 2. This Jesus whom you crucified at the hands of lawless men, God has made him both Lord and Christ, of whom we've all, you know, we're witnesses of these things. But the message was still, repent and be baptized. The message was, repent of that sin. It's not unforgivable. Is it terrible? Yeah, absolutely. But think, for instance, of some of the great men of faith that were murderers. You know, King David, a murderer, but a man after God's own heart. He was forgiven for that. Saul of Tarsus, you know, breathing out threats and murders against the church. Better believe he was responsible for the death of several Christians, good people serving their God. But he was forgiven. Perhaps the most ironic of all of these is that the very man who issued these Ten Commandments to the people, who brought down the Ten Commandments, Moses, remember when he was in Egypt? He was trying to do the right thing, but he murdered the Egyptian man and hid him in the sand. Moses himself being a murderer and telling these people, don't murder. He probably had an understanding there. But the point is that Jesus says there's more to it than just the action. But not only that, the gospel is still for those people as well. The gospel is for all. Practically speaking, while the Old Testament talks about different degrees and it gives us gracious provisions with the cities of refuge, we still ask, is murder the worst sin? Maybe we ask, what could be worse than murder? And I don't want to rephrase the question and say, what are things that are as bad as murder? I didn't put this on the screen because the screen would have to reach down to the floor to have this whole list. Other things in the Old Testament that were punishable by death. I'm just going to go through them really quickly. And remember that these are all in this on the same page. So if you think murder is the worst of the worst, get ready to bring some of these up to par, okay? Premeditated murder, obviously. Kidnapping, adultery, homosexuality, incest, bestiality, delinquency, and disobedience to parents and authority. Same consequence as murder. Offering human sacrifice, false prophecy, blasphemy against God, profaning the Sabbath, and sacrificing to false gods. These things all have the same consequence as murder. And so we think, oh, that's just the worst of the worst. There's a lot of things that we do and that mankind does today, that just because they don't have the same criminal consequences, in the eyes of God, they are just as sinful as murder. James later equates all sins. He brings them all together. In James chapter 2 and verse 10 and 11, he says there, whoever keeps the whole law but fails in one point has become accountable for all of it. Verse 11, for he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. If you do not commit adultery, but you do murder, you've become a transgressor of the law. And vice versa, if you commit adultery but don't murder, you're still a transgressor of the law. He brings them all on the same level. And so for the rest of our time, the few minutes we have left, I want us to think about how we can break this command today without ever laying a hand on someone, without ever actually taking a life. How can we break this command today? 3 points there, and then a few points to take home with us about what we do about it. How can we take positive action from a command like this? Number one, when we miss the principle behind the command, when we miss the point altogether, when we read through it and we say, you shall not murder, check, I've never murdered anyone, moving on. You've missed the point. And I think we made that clear with some of the teachings of Jesus, the way we treat other people, the love that we're ultimately to have for others, the way that God loved us. Not a lot of people, in the grand scheme of things, kill other people. Not a lot of people commit murder. But if we understand why it's wrong and what God thinks about it, that's going to help lead us to positive actions toward our neighbors. Positive actions that demonstrate that love. Number two, if we narrow down who we must love, Luke chapter 10 in verses 25 through 28 there is the parable of the Good Samaritan. And the man asks, who is my neighbor? What are the commands? Love your neighbor as yourself, but trying to test him, he says, who is my neighbor? Tells him the story about this man. We know the story of the Good Samaritan. What the Jews of that day were trying to do is limit the command of God to love your neighbors. They're saying, well, I love other Jews. And I'm fulfilling the command. After all, we're special. We're special, y'all. In the church, that could be manifest as us showing great love for people in the church, people who are Christians, but not showing that love for people in the world. Thinking that maybe since we've got the gospel message and we've been forgiven of our sins, that maybe we're a little better off than some of the people in our community. That attitude is pervasive even among the Lord's people, and it ought not be, just as it shouldn't have been for the Jews at that point. When we try to narrow down who my neighbor is, when we try to think, when we only have concern for the lives that it's easy to care about, but we aren't too concerned with people that we think maybe deserve what they got in life. Life is still valuable. Life is still precious to God. Thirdly, if we justify our personal sins by comparing it with what we think are the bad sins. Well, I've never murdered anybody, so what I did really isn't a big deal. We're missing the point, aren't we? So those are some ways that I think we could break this command not to murder. But what about for us today? How do we take this home? What are some positive things that we can do? Well, obviously, this is the statement of the day here, obvious statement of the day, we don't have the right to take the life of another individual. I want to add in here, there are times when we take that into our own hands. We as Christians, we as a society, many people, of course, you talk about abortion. People think that they have the right to take life. They don't. God has that right, and He has not given us that right to take life. Euthanasia is sort of the other end of the spectrum. And there are, I'm not pretending to understand all that goes on and all that's involved with that. But we think about the things that could constitute murder, taking the right that we don't, a life that we don't have a right to take. Number two, murder is wrong when it is a seed that's planted in our hearts. When we start to feel anger, when we are embittered against others, when we hold grudges, when we don't forgive, when we don't reconcile with other people, Jesus says, you need to take care of that problem. Those are sinful thoughts. Those are sinful attitudes. We've got to cleanse our hearts toward other people. Love your neighbor. If we love our neighbor, we're not going to have this great anger toward them. We're not going to hold grudges against them. We will reconcile our differences. He says, lay your gift at the altar and go and take care of the problem. Go and take care of it. We need to remember that life is sacred, that human life is very important, and that it is placed on God. And as far as that goes, if a physical life is of great importance to God, if the human life with blood coursing through its veins is precious and sacred in the eyes of God, what does that tell us about the soul inside of a man, in the soul that we all have, the spiritual life of an individual? How much more sacred is that? And if that is the case, we need to see the urgency and the priority of evangelism, to be seeking after people to save their spiritual lives. And as he says in John chapter 3, verses 15 and 16, if you want to love your brother, you need to be willing to lay your life down for your brother, to give preference to others. As Cain was asked by God, he said, Cain, where is your brother? And he says, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? The answer is yes. We are our brother's keeper. We are responsible for their well-being, for taking care of them, for looking out for them, and they are for us. We're to give preference and honor one another above ourselves, willing to lay down our lives for the good of other people. If it comes to that, we are our brother's keeper. You know, maybe murder is not on your mind, but could the seeds of murder be growing in your heart? Could that anger and those grudges and those unreconciled problems, could that be dwelling in your heart today? We need to be on guard. We need to constantly treat others as more important than ourselves and understand that ultimately life is sacred. It belongs to God. And the life that He cares the most about is not the one here that we have, but our spiritual lives. And He cares about yours today. If you're in danger of losing your spiritual life, if you've never come to God in baptism for the remission of your sins,